When Sex and the City was first broadcast on HBO in 1998, few could have predicted that it would become a worldwide multi-million dollar sensation. Now, Carrie Bradshaw and her three BFFs are back for a second film. And joining me now is Michael Patrick King, the writer, producer, and director of Sex and the City 2, which opens nationwide this coming Thursday, May 27th. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Hi, I'm thrilled to be here. Can you imagine having a two after a movie? It's quite a blockbuster. I always underline the her at the end.
Yeah, it's usually the Rambos and those kinds of Star Trek 28. The first movie, which was released 2 years ago, grossed $415 million worldwide. I suspect you knew that you had a devoted fan base, but not that big.
No, no one expected that. I hoped when we sat down to write the first movie that all I could do was to please the devoted audience that had been following these girls since they were 33 on HBO. And it turns out after we went off the air, due to the DVDs and syndication, they kept growing and growing and growing. And so by the time we went around, literally I was lucky enough to go around the world with that opening, London, Berlin, Tokyo, Paris. And when I got there, what stunned me was all these girls had girls waiting for them, like their friends. And I thought, it's kind of a global friendship. And I think the experience of seeing all that is what made me think that the second movie should have a more global feel.
Well, how soon after the first one came out did you start talking about making a second film?
It wasn't everybody thinks we have these all lined up like pinballs, like they're pinballs, they're just ready to go. We put everything we knew about the first movie on the screen with the first movie. I didn't have a thought. And then when the box office, which I call love, translated to money and Hollywood came and said, you want to do another one? It always comes from the story. So I would say months, you know, to sit down and think of a story. And then when I had a story that I thought would be different, because I have one rule, and I've been writing Sex and the City since the beginning, don't repeat. So I knew that it had to be different than the first movie. And when I decided it was going to be more of a romp and an extravaganza, then I was ready to start thinking about the story.
You also decided not to just pick up where the last one left off. You've allowed for the intervening 2 years.
It is important because, you know, I think the intervening time of not seeing these girls is important because you get the sense that this is moving forward and evolving. I think the one mistake we could have made was trying to freeze the girls at a certain age on TV and say, okay, you're 36, now stay there and don't get married. And the first thing I did was break that rule and have Charlotte get married in the third season. And the fun thing about not seeing them, there's the curiosity of how they're going to be in the interim years. And the interesting parallel to me is I believe that the audience is evolving with the characters. And so in 2 years, things happen to you. Maybe you've gotten divorced. Maybe you've had another child. Maybe you're married for the first time. Or maybe you're still single. But your life should be somehow reflected in the lives up on the screen as well.
Well, for much of the series on television, they were Carrie, Samantha, Charlotte, and Miranda were trying to establish themselves.
It's
no longer an issue.
Know, but Leonard, the thing that I love about it is an issue. And that's what's interesting about this story to me, is that Carrie Bradshaw, who had defined herself as the ultimate single girl, and then since then pop culture defined her as the ultimate single girl, has to now deal with defining herself in a more traditional label, not a designer label, but wife. So what I like about this big extravaganza, this big sort of Bing Crosby, Bob Hope current romp, is that in the middle of it is Carrie Bradshaw is trying to figure out how to be a traditional wife, if that's what she's supposed to do.
So this could have been called We're on the Road to Abu Dhabi?
Or The Road to Manolo. I chose Abu Dhabi for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons was I wanted to go someplace that I couldn't imagine anyone had ever been. And I try to be as current as possible. And when I sat down to write the script, I knew we were in an economic downturn here in a lot of places. And I thought, well, if I want the vibe to be extravagant, where is there no downturn? And the Middle East came up, and because Samantha's character gets them there and she's always sort of portrayed as the cutting-edge publicist, I looked around and what was the cutting-edge travel destination? It was Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and I chose to put them in Abu Dhabi because it had a little bit more of a magical, faraway, unknown sound to it.
Well, it's a city that's trying to navigate between long-established local traditions and also establishing itself as a world-class city.
That's what I love about it. And I think that the theme of the movie is really how current, even cosmopolitan cities like New York, people are dealing with traditional roles such as wife or mother or working or aging.
Could you have filmed it in Abu Dhabi? You filmed it in Morocco.
We filmed it in Morocco
you?
Because it's, you know, I have four female storylines, which is a lot of filming. It's a big, hearty movie. So we needed to film someplace where they already had a history of film. And the minute we landed on the ground in Morocco, we were running. Plus, they had those amazing visuals. Those dunes are the same dunes where they filmed Lawrence of Arabia. So I have to say, as a filmmaker, I was hooked.
It's also a secular Muslim country, you don't have some of the problems you might have had elsewhere.
It's much more of a big mix. And
are there censors there?
We were treated very well. I mean, it was a beautiful experience because we're living in the film community. I mean, you know, individuals have opinions that I really can't speak for because I don't know them. But as the film community, everybody seemed to be very happy to do something that was comic in that part of the country or glamorous because mostly the films that they're allowed to make there are jeeps, guns, chasing, war, whatever. And here we were on with Hermes and Chanel on camels, and it was kind of a treat.
Now, you talked about writing many of the Sex and the City episodes. You also wrote for The Comeback, mm-hmm. Murphy Brown, mm-hmm. Will and Grace, mm-hmm. Sybil.
Yeah.
All television.
Yeah.
Had you written another feature film before you first SATC?
I did the big hat trick. My first movie was Sex and the City, the first one. And it was a comfortable start because I knew the characters. But still, I think our big struggle on the first movie was to prove that it was a movie. You know what I mean? And prove that the emotions and the vibrations of the television show could be carried big. And it was a really beautiful way to start because I had the comfort of these characters that people love, but still the challenge of making it a movie.
You also were directing You had directed some of the TV shows?
Directed the TV shows, won an Emmy or two for directing, but never had done a feature. And it's a different ballgame, let me tell you.
Although many people tell me that directing an HBO show is more like directing a movie than directing a network sitcom.
Which is why I never thought it was going to be a leap to go from the small screen to the big screen, because some of those HBO episodes, you know, when we started on HBO, they didn't have a jam-packed schedule. I mean, we came on right the summer before The Sopranos. So at sometimes I would say to, you know, Chris Albert, who is the head of HBO, I think this episode is 38 minutes. And he'd look at it and go, yeah, that's good, 38 minutes. And the more successful it became, make it 30, because they had other shows to back it up. But even within that limited 30 minutes, there were some episodes that had 38 scenes. And that's very filmic to have that much story.
In an odd way, you probably had a little more freedom on the HBO shows. You could show more nudity.
We have never been told to not show nudity in the movie. As a matter of fact, the only time I filmed a male from full frontal was in the first movie. It was R. And when we went to New Line and Warner Brothers, one of the first questions they asked themselves is, what should the rating be? And they came away with the idea from an in-house poll that people would not trust a Sex and the City that wasn't rated R. They'd feel like they were getting like little Muppet Sex and the City movie. You know,
or
like
Channel 11 Sex and the City.
Yeah, which is interesting because my mother, who is Irish in 86, and we never had a conversation about sex, she's always said to me that the movie and the series is really about the love of those four friends. And, you know, when you look at it in syndication, that's what it is about. Because every time Samantha opens her mouth, she'll lean in occasionally and she'll go, ladies, and then you cut to the next scene. And I'm like, ladies, you never know what Samantha's going to say, which is sad because the jokes were so good. We were the first people to really tell jokes about sex. And I think our big claim to fame is that we took sex out of the dark and put a little pink fuzz and champagne around it.
You also dealt with subjects that people do talk about, but not in the movies or television.
Yeah, people say to me, do women really talk like that? And I say, well, they would if they had a writing staff. and my feeling is that the reason Sex and the City, the series, became connected to the audience is because we said the things that maybe you were thinking, and we just said it a week before you. It wasn't like we were so far ahead of the curve that it was unrelatable. It just, no one had said it, and not these four amazing actresses. I mean, when you hear Sarah Jessica Parker talking to Kristen Davis and Cynthia Nixon and Kim Cattrall in a cab about, do you want to be Mr. or do you want to be Mrs. Up the Butt? I mean, no one had ever said that before, and I don't even know if you can say it here as I see your eyes roll back in your head.
Well, I'm just hoping that the FCC isn't listening.
Fabulous Control Center.
Michael Patrick King is the writer, producer, and director of Sex and the City, both films, and many of the television shows. Sex and the City 2 opens nationwide this coming Thursday. And you've been living with these characters for a long time. You, as I said, you did any number of other TV series, but nothing that lasted this long.
Well, nothing will ever catch like this again. I mean, if I'm lucky enough to do other work that is well-received, that's one thing, but it will never be this.
Well, you've been living with these people for 12 years.
I have. This is my most committed relationship, and it's with four women.
And does it present a challenge when you sit down to write a screenplay for, in this case, a second film? These people have... pretty much you've addressed all the taboos, but you have all of these complicated things that have happened in the past. I wonder whether you had to research to keep track of some of the past wrinkles in their lives.
Well, you know what's interesting is, first of all, you say the word wrinkle, and I'm going to put that right to the word taboo, because when we started the series, the taboo was sex. Ooh, they're talking about sex. Ooh, women talking about sex. The shocking thing from the press aspect when I did one-on-one interviews on the first movie was that we let Samantha turn 50. Oh, a woman's going to say she's 50 in a movie? That's impossible.
So, well, she'd already had cancer.
She'd already had cancer. So, you know, and as far as the other stories that we've done, what I like about the challenge, it is a challenge, as you said, because we took out a lot of story areas. You know, four storylines every week. For 6 years, that's a lot of love stories. So I like the fact that I'm challenged to find something new. But as long as I'm plugged into what's happening in the real world around me and these characters are allowed to evolve, there'll always be a new story, like in this, with Samantha going through the change and refusing to change.
Although she's the only one who isn't in a fairly settled relationship.
And never will be, because I think it would be unfair to have all four girls married, because it started out as single girls. And the joy of writing four characters all that represent women is that there are four of them. So, and even in this movie, there's a great kind of poignant moment about Carrie Bradshaw having children or not having children. And there are two other women that have children. And so what about those women that don't have children?
Throughout the series, whenever things were going really well for a character... she was always being set up for some fall of some
sort. We called them cream pies, like in the W.C. Fields cream pie.
Usually a funny one, like the W.C. Fields cream pie. Is there something that you wanted to bring to the movie, or are the women in a different stage of their lives?
Yeah, I think that the biggest cream pie I ever threw, the hugest, most devastating cream pie, was to Carrie Bradshaw in the last movie, who dressed herself all up in a big wedding gown and stood up at the altar. To me, I knew that the story I had in the first movie was Carrie and Big get married, because wherever I went, smart women always said to me, "Do you think they got married?" So I knew I had a good story there. But the cream pie was, of course, that it blew up in her face. So in this movie, the challenge for Carrie Bradshaw is that I have unearthed one of my favorite parts of her, the bad Carrie. Because there's the good Carrie and then there's the impulsive bad Carrie, and they're both existing in this movie.
And you flipped it with Chris Noth, Big,
who,
by the way, is still playing bad husbands on a TV series,
but the good wife.
But here he is probably the most decent character in this movie.
I think it's a really nice evolution. And, you know, Chris, I heard him the other day. He said that the evolution of Mr. Big went from a guy with a cool head to a warm heart. And I think it's really important. And the men of Sex and the City, these gentlemen, you know, Mr. Big and Harry, Charlotte's husband, and Steve, Miranda's husband, and even Samantha's very few love interests are important. They're the unsung heroes because they are the struggle. So if the women are struggling over men that aren't worth anything, then they are a bit foolish. And I think that's where you start to detach from relatability with the audience.
And you're not worried that people will be a little upset with Carrie for
being a lot more
than a bit immature in this film?
I love it. I love that there's a flaw in her. I love it. I think it's really interesting. I like that people say to Carrie, "Oh, what are you doing?" It makes within this big road picture, this big old-fashioned Hollywood movie with a current sort of sensibility, it makes this tiny little human heart, this girl might make a mistake.
The film opens with these gorgeous shots of New York City. Many people felt that the TV series was, that New York was one of the characters.
I agree. It was a very big and very, it was a very fertile farm. I mean, all you have to do is walk through New York City and you'd get a story idea. That's why it was so exciting to write it here.
But in both films, you leave New York City.
Yes. Well, in the first film, we left for faux Mexico, which was really filmed in California. And we were there for basically a week. And in this movie, again, because I always try to challenge myself to do something different. And I thought that I wanted to see a movie where the four girls were back together again. And, you know, with their storylines having husbands and babies, the only story I could come up with was Samantha's single and she lassos them and brings them back to the four girls that we knew so long ago before all of that.
Fantasy is an integral part of the series and the movies. The clothes, the parties, mm-hmm. the men, mm-hmm. the friendships. Mm-hmm. Does that make it harder to get to the emotional truth of these characters?
I love the aspirational quality of this. I think it's part of my job to make something as beautiful as I can. And I think one of the reasons that people still watch the show in syndication is the attention to the detail of the product. But I love that there's these big, big colors and big, big sort of aspirational moments because I know what the girls are going to play underneath it all. Is the humanity and the reality of the heartbreak of being human. Well, and less than perfect, no matter how perfect your situation is.
You can't talk about Sex and the City without talking about the clothes. What did you tell costume designer Patricia Field you wanted in this movie?
I love that this movie almost splits into two. The New York part of the movie, sort of I had a thought that it's, since there is an homage to black and white movies actually in the movie, that it would have more of that top hat New York, that glitter, glamour, that Preston Sturges opening 30 screwball. You know, there's gowns and pretty, and the motif is very, very old New York and very pretty. And then the second part of the movie is mad. It's just crazy colors, girls on vacation. And what I love about it is Pat and I had to actually have a creative struggle to figure out how to do these girls in a more traditional culture where their shoulders became the most forbidden part of the body. So Pat would like put all these dresses out there that were like halter tops. And Pat, I could see the shoulders. And she like, what do you want me to do? They're on vacation. And so she wound up wrapping them and making T-shirts into jackets. So when you're looking at the Middle Eastern part of the movie, you're seeing a costume design that defies logic, and it's very creative.
Well, I've heard that when the series started, you couldn't get a loan from a fashion house.
No, Sarah Jessica used to beg.
And now the shoe is most definitely on the other foot.
It is definitely. The shoes are on the other foot. And you know what's interesting about it? It is really, it's almost like a revolving door of couture because none of this stuff do you really own. It goes back. And everything in the movie pays off. Pat went to Turkey. The bathing suit Samantha's wearing in the movie comes from Turkey, and it's worth every bit of the trip.
I just wonder what a young woman who's watching this film in some Midwestern town thinks about New York. Do they really think people dress that way?
Yes, they do, and they do dress that way. And, you know, someone said to me, because I live in the meatpacking district, and someone said to me, what do you think when you see girls running around in groups of four in those high heels and those skimpy dresses? What do you think about that? And I say, what do you think when you see guys on the subway going to the Yankees game wearing a Yankees jacket? That's what I think. I think it's their team.
You've been credited or perhaps blamed for making the meatpacking district as popular as it is. I'm going to reserve judgment.
You should reserve judgment. And everyone should reserve judgment until they take a walk on the Highline Park because it's an amazing – we're not credited with any of that. What New York does and why it's been so fascinating to film in all these years is it turns itself into something new.
Just one more thing. Mm-hmm. Are you working on an SATC 3?
I thought you were going to say SAT scores. I was like, aren't we having a test? This is what I expected from you. It's suddenly a pop quiz IQ test. No, I haven't thought about anything. We're like this crazy traveling troupe that comes through town and throws. It's like a circus. We put the tent up. We do our act. We don't even know what city's coming next. We do it out. We put it all up on the screen, and we hope people like it. I had no intention or thought of Sex and the City 2 when I did Sex and the City 1. And the last word in this movie is today. And that's kind of where we all are today.
Michael Patrick King has been our guest today. He's the writer, producer, and director of Sex and the City 2, which opens nationwide this coming Thursday, May 27th. Thank you so much for being with us.
It has been my pleasure.
More than a million young people have dropped out of the job market because they're discouraged by the economy. As college students across America graduate this week, we're asking you, what advice would you give to new grads? We want your one-sentence commencement speech. Pull out your phone and text TAKE to 69866. You might be charged for it. That's tomorrow on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. Weekday mornings on AM 820 WNYC.